Today's April 1st, 2015. This is the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Natural Resources. Today is a continuation on the public hearing on Senate Bill 5511. So we'll go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 5511. Before we turn it over to Director Melcher, we will hear from Mr. Seward.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to note for the record that the department provided some answers to questions from the previous 2 days. Hearings, and those answers are saved under Monday's date, I believe. And there's also responses on the website viewings, the legal costs, and some other information about wildlife viewing.
All right. And actually, I think I misspoke. We have to turn it over to Mr. Bowles, right? From the Director Melcher's going to chat first.
Thank you, Co-Chair Ray Field, members of the committee. For the record, Kurt Melcher, Director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife. And before Mr. Bowles resumes his Fish Division, Fish Program update, I did want to recognize that we do have one of our commissioners in the audience here today, Ms. Bobby Levy. She's from the thriving community of Echo, Oregon, in eastern Oregon. She's currently sits in the Congressional District 2 seat, which encompasses all of eastern Oregon, as well as a little dogleg piece of southwest Oregon as well. So I just want to recognize that she's here in the audience with us today.
Excellent. Thank you.
So Chair Rayfield and committee, once again, my name is Ed Bowles. I'm the Fish Division Administrator. I'm going to continue where we left off, and just to remind you, we were chatting a little bit about the Inland Fisheries section, one of two sections within Fish Division, and I was just accentuating the kind of basis for our management, one of which is to establish a real strong conservation platform upon which then we can do our fisheries and other things. And we're on a slide that I think really accentuates this. This is a slide that shows the Oregon chub recovery effort, and this is, of course, a non-fished fish and represents a minnow endemic to the Willamette Valley. And so this is really a tribute because it's the first federally listed fish to be both recovered and delisted in the nation. And it just so happens that in its name is Oregon. So it's really put us on the map and is a tribute to not only our efforts on conservation, but our partnerships represented with landowners, with other agencies. This happened to be the federal agency, the Fish and Wildlife Service, that was overseeing this recovery. But our department really led the effort in getting these fish identified, finding additional populations, restoring populations, and then led the delisting effort. So a real tribute there. Once again, another program within our inland fisheries is the Screens and Passage Program. And just by way of orienting you, think of screens as those activities that keep the fish from going where they don't belong, and passage is those that ensure the fish can get to where they belong. And these two are on-the-ground programs, very important for our agency, but also for landowners and local governments, municipalities, agencies, because it's a partnership where we work with them to ensure that the screens and passage programs are complementary to their activities on the ground. And this is throughout the state. It's a big, daunting task. There are still a lot of unscreened diversions and passage issues, but we are working with our publics on those and making good progress throughout the year. Another program is hatchery management. And just give you a quick orientation on how we go about managing our hatcheries. Obviously, we want our hatcheries to achieve their objectives, whether it be a conservation or fishery, bringing fish back for people to catch. But in addition to that, we want our hatcheries to be good residents in their watersheds. relative to their pathogens, relative to their pollutant discharge, all of that. So that's a key part of that. And we also want these hatchery fish to be good neighbors to their wild fish counterparts. And so all of that is very important part of the package of managing our hatcheries. We take this very seriously. In fact, the Oregon Hatchery Research Center is a key part of this, located in the Alsea Drainage. It's kind of oversight of research going on to help us make sure hatchery fish are complementary to our wild fish management needs. I'll take a little bit of time on the hatchery programs because it is a very big part of what we do. We have 32 hatcheries. 18 of those are what we call mitigation hatcheries, and this means that these hatcheries are either federally or private entity mitigation for dams that were constructed in either blocked passage or reduced survival of fish. And so these mitigation programs produce the lion's share of what we produce in our hatcheries. We release nearly 50 million fish, and of those, the majority of them are marked because they're mostly salmon and steelhead and part of those fisheries. I did want to just mention that the infrastructure in the agency has tied up a lot of that in our hatchery programs, and we have an ongoing challenge with deferred maintenance. And address that as best we can through federal dollars as well as R&E dollars that I'll chat about in a minute. This is an ongoing challenge that we take seriously and continue to look for opportunities to meaningfully address these deferred maintenance. Hatcheries provide a very high return for the investment that the state makes. It helps support over 500,000 anglers and over 8 million angler days each year. Angling opportunities are every day of the year, and for our hatchery program, only one quarter of every dollar is state dollars that go to support that. So there is a tremendous support through private and federal dollars as well. And the economic benefits are huge, both to rural areas as well as to the overall state. They also serve as kind of a destination for many folks. We get over 1.5 million visits to our hatcheries each year. That's pretty huge. We use this as an opportunity to educate the public, not only on fish culture activities, but also on watershed stewardship and other fish management and conservation. We also use our public to help us run some of our hatcheries through a volunteer force, and some of this is through our STEP program. This is pretty exciting because we get over, you know, $2 million worth of help if these were actually staff in our relationship with our public. And this is a very willing sort of participation from our public and provides us an avenue to get youth and others involved in fish management and is very popular where we do this. Shift to another program. This oversees our recreational fisheries throughout the state outside of the Marine and Columbia River. And one of the key pieces of their kind of priority focus is on simplifying access and opportunity for fishing, making fishing better through simplification. And there's no doubt that our regulations right now are a barrier to participation. Any of you that do fish know that the brochure is daunting. And we are making pretty significant strides in simplifying the regulations, but with a backdrop of Endangered Species Act and the complexity of our management, we're not going to be able to really get that all the way to where we need to go. And I think the key here, and Director Melcher spoke to this, is going digital with our regulations and making sure that the public only needs to dig as deep as they want to in order to find out what to do. And this is a very exciting piece that we've got through our mobile application. We hope to roll this out in the not-too-distant future, which will allow us to actually cite wherever a person is, what they can fish, what's available there, what the regulations are, and how to go about doing that. So it's a pretty exciting thought. Juvenile license are another great way to get at this. Director Melcher mentioned this, that we have an actual reduction in our overall package for the cost to enter into a fishery if you're a youth. And basically $10 is a one-stop shopping for fishing and hunting. Restoring lakes and reservoirs that have been either overrun with invasive species or others to provide additional fishing, and then access throughout trying to find areas within public and private areas for easy access of the public. This is just one of our web applications that I think folks are really finding useful. We have over 400,000 visits since this was launched a couple years ago. And this shows where our hatchery trout are planted. Each section of the state has maps, web-based maps, where you can go and find out where you're likely to find some of our hatchery trout programs. Another one is access through for folks with disabilities. This is another web-based application where you can look on the web and find out if you are a person with disabilities, where you can get access in order to fish. Another program I mentioned briefly earlier is our Restoration Enhancement Program. This is a surcharge put on both sport and commercial fishing for salmon that provides money for on-the-ground actions. And a lot of this goes towards our hatchery program, as well as education, some of our monitoring. But we use this substantively to help with some of our deferred maintenance issues within the state, making sure our hatcheries are shored up and water supplies are good and our raceways and other things are in good shape. And we've had over $50 million dollars spent on this since its creation and thousands of projects, and this is a very successful program. We also have a water program within the inland fisheries. And this program is constantly challenged with finding that kind of sweet spot, if you will, where we're balancing the needs of the fish with the needs of water users. And that's always a constant challenge. And we provide the technical support in order to help folks understand what those needs of the fish are. We also involved in Columbia River water, as well as the Integrated Water Resource Strategy implementation. And this is not just regional water planning, but it's also dealing with some of the development of the in-stream rights, as well as the out-of-stream needs, and surface and groundwater storage. Okay, now I'm going to shift now to the other section within the division, and this is the Marine and Columbia River section. And I'll just go through some of the fisheries that we manage in this program. We've got several significant policy issues and challenges within this program. One of them is, of course, conservation and recovery, particularly in the Columbia River. But as I mentioned yesterday, this is really this is a place where we manage with partners. And so we don't do this alone. So federal, state, and tribal co-managers make this a very complicated fisheries to manage. And we also have energy development needs, particularly in the ocean, that are just starting. You've probably all heard about the pinniped or the sea lion and seal predation. This particular year is one of the highest numbers of pinnipeds that we've ever seen in the Columbia River. Bycatch reduction, I'll talk about that a little bit later. Invasive species, and of course, climate change and the ocean acidification that's associated with that. So the Marine and Columbia programs really represent a huge portion of the state's fisheries, much of the recreational, but essentially all of our commercial. It's a major economic driver, $1.5 billion per biennium. And this is not just in the coastal and rural areas, but it is permeates throughout the state. I want to just touch on, I think, one of the most important parts of the way we manage our fisheries in the ocean, and that is the collaboration we have with our fleets. We really walk hand in hand with them. They recognize these are mature fisheries, and the participants recognize that without working with us, they end up getting constrained because of different species of fish mixed in with those fisheries. And if you look as an example, the lower left shows bycatch reduction in our pink shrimp fishery. And this is one where on the left, you'll see that the shiny white fish there are not targeted. We want this to be a clean fishery with just those pink shrimp. In this case, you could have even listed fish like the Ulacon or Pacific smelt mixed in. And through research with the fleet, we've been able to reduce that bycatch and focus the fishery very cleanly on just the pink shrimp in this case. And this is an example throughout our marine fisheries where we have what is called the Marine Stewardship Council Certification for Sustainable Fisheries. And we are leaders in the nation in the proportion of our marine fisheries that actually are certified as sustainable. It's nearly three-quarters of our fisheries, and it's something we are very proud of. And once again, this is working hand-in-hand with our fleets in a way that is progressive and has a conservation orientation, and then working with our partners federally and state. Another example of some of our stewardship activities is if any of you have been out bottom fishing through a charter on the ocean, you know that sometimes when you bring up these fish, they can have what we call bear trauma. It's similar to bends in divers. And you need to get those fish back down so that they can repressurize as quickly as possible. And so we have worked with the charters and others in order to develop a technique of getting those fish back down to depth so they can repressurize, and their survival rates have gone up dramatically. It's allowed us to have these fisheries where we're targeting, for example, black rockfish, but allowing folks to release yellow eye or canary rockfish, which aren't targeted. Some of you may recall that not too long ago, we established marine reserves and had the benefit of that being supported through the legislation. And we are still ongoing with that research and working with five marine reserve sites in our territorial sea. And this is a part, once again, of a cooperative relationship with our public and our fleets in working forward on those, learning not just the ecological aspects of marine reserves, but also the social and economic. And so we have numerous studies ongoing that are looking at the effects of these marine reserves on the local community's economics, as well as the social aspects of that. Those of you that have been to the ocean know that there is a lot of energy tied up in the waves, the tides, and the winds. And so obviously there's a desire for harnessing some of that energy. We are involved with Ocean Energy in trying to help support this local energy development in a way, though, that does not undermine the existing marine resources that are so important to our coast and state economy. And so we are involved in this in advisory capacity to help make sure that this developing technology is done in a way that continues that stewardship of the marine resources. Lastly, the nearshore, which is our territorial sea, extends out to 3 nautical miles. And we would like to get actually more authority to kind of self-regulate and self-manage our nearshore species and our nearshore habitats. Right now, we do that primarily in partnership with the federal government. And we are dedicating a lot of effort on understanding our nearshore better. You can see a video clip here of some of our remote-operated vehicles and our sleds that are used to take video of these to help sample and understand the nearshore habitats and the species. We are also involved, you may have heard, with the Japanese tsunami and the landing of some of the debris from that, including getting on top of potential invasive species that came with some of that debris. And then you may have also heard about sea star wasting disease, which is still a bit unknown, but we are working with the federal government and academics on trying to figure out exactly what's going on and what can be done about this, just as an example of some of our focus on the nearshore. So I will leave it at that and answer any questions you might have, Chair Rayfield.
All right, Senator Denbrough.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I do have a question about where we are with the sea lions, the predation from the pinnipeds. What are the trend lines there? What what actions are we taking to remove them? And I'm hearing from constituents who have concerns about the killing of sea lions. So I wonder if you could speak to that.
Sure. Chair Rayfield and Senator Dembro. The really where we come at this is recognizing and respecting the sea lions and seals as an apex predator. They're only doing what they're built to do. And we absolutely kind of ring the dinner bell for them as a society by creating barriers to some of our salmon and steelhead, which allow them to have easy access. Okay. But given that, there is definitely a need to bring that predation in balance with the recovery needs of salmon and steelhead, which are federally listed both in the Willamette River and in the Columbia River. The marine mammals are protected by a federal act called the Marine Mammal Protection Act, and we have worked through sections of that in order to get the authority to manage and euthanize or kill some levels of these for habitual predators. Okay, these are individuals that have demonstrated over time that they've been a problem, and we use that to gain the authority to remove some. And we have done that. It is important to continue that. It is currently only occurring in the Columbia River, where we have that authority, not in the Willamette. We have also done extensive hazing, which is, you know, kind of firecrackers and other ways of trying to keep these predators away from the face of the dams and away from fisheries. That is important, but it really just distributes these predators elsewhere, and so it is not a long-term solution. The killing of them is also, at the current levels, not a long-term solution. Right now, we have a huge number, an unprecedented number, of pinnipeds in the lower Columbia River. They followed the smelt in, which are cyclical, and so with this run of smelt, they came in. The smelt are on the downturn now. They spawn and die, and so now we have these predators in there still eating, still staying, and it's a big concern. We believe that a long-term solution is really some sort of a surgical fix to the Marine Mammal Protection Act that allows us and others to actively manage these predators, to bring them into balance, not to get rid of them by any stretch, but to make sure there's a balance there with their prey base, and that's the long-term solution.
So how long do you see them hanging around down in the lower Columbia? I mean, I understand, you know, the dams are a problem because it's, you know, they can just hang out and feed. Is it just the availability of fish that's keeping them? Is it the ocean temperatures further down south that's bringing them up?
Chair Rayfield and Senator Dembro, there's... We typically get two pulses or peaks of the pinniped activity in the spring and the fall. And these are males for the sea lions that are here. And typically they tend to go south very soon, you know, well, within the next couple months so that they can reproduce. We have noticed through our tracking that the availability and desire to have all this great food sometimes supersedes their desire to go south and mate, and so we've had males stay much longer and even avoid the trip south. And so it's becoming more and more of a problem, but typically it's a spring and a big spring pulse and then a smaller fall pulse where they are here. And we do not have a good handle on whether or not this current high numbers that we're seeing is a result of some sort of ocean conditions or temperatures. I personally think it's more related to them following the food. In this case, it was a good run of smelt that came in, and they will follow that in, and now they're here and preying. And it's not just the salmon and steelhead, but also sturgeon that they really can prey heavily on.
And one final question. You know, you mentioned that there's an effort to target problem sea lions. So what constitutes a problem sea lion?
Chair Rayfield and Senator Dembro, the way we kind of set the table for the authorization to be able to manage some of these is through demonstrating these habitual you know, that they prey on the salmon that are listed, and they're seen numerous times. And so they end up being marked through a kind of a brand, if you will. And then we then observe those over and over again in the act of preying. And that's what initially allowed us to move forward with the management authorization.
Okay, but I mean, they're made to eat the salmon and steelhead, right? I mean.
Yes, that's correct. And so they are.
So I mean, how do you distinguish between those who do and those who don't? I mean, those who don't will be dead or go away, right?
Yeah, they're all going to eat. They eat different species of fish. Like I said, they come in and to prey on, in this case, on the Pacific smelt. Some of the marking that occurs down near the mouth of the river, but the observation occur at the dam. And so that's how you know that these are there. And there may only be, let's say, 150 of these predators at the face of Bonneville, whereas you may be in the thousands in the overall river. So we want to, the authorization is for those targeted up there, not throughout the river. So the management doesn't occur down below.
Thank you. Any other questions? All right. We'll continue on to the administration side.
Good morning, Chair Rayfield, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Herber, Acting Deputy Director for Administration. And given the sake of time, I'll quickly run you through the administrative side of the agency. So our administration supports two distinct customers. Internally, we provide support for the Fish and Wildlife Program staff that directly implement our mission. And externally, we provide services such as licensing and information education to the general public at large. So this makes for a wide gamut of work that our administration performs. We provide these services through four divisions: administrative services, human resources, information services, and information and education divisions. But before I get into detail on those divisions, I'd like to take a moment to highlight some of the core concepts that have been at the fabric of how we've been approaching our administration this biennium. So much like the natural resources side of the agency, our work in administration is becoming increasingly complex with increased demands and limited resources. So we've had to change the way we've approached our business. And you've heard Director Melcher speak earlier that this biennium we've reduced the administrative footprint of our administration, yet we haven't cut services or reduced the scope of our work. And we've accomplished this by fundamentally changing the way we've been approaching our business. First, we focused on cost savings and efficiencies. Monday, you heard about some of the major efficiencies we've made this biennium, such as our regional consolidation or our fleet management strategies. Well, behind those major numbers, there's a multitude of little ones that add up to significant savings, things such as adjusting our janitorial contracts. What's most amazing here is most of these efficiency ideas are generated by frontline staff, and we're actively implementing these efficiency ideas throughout our administration, so it's a very effective system for us. System modernization is also key to us moving forward, leveraging automation to reduce the workload on staff and reducing the complexity of their work. This biennium, we introduced a new accounts receivable or a billing system, and that really made that billing process much more efficient. To give you an example of that, previously our billing process took an entire month to do and involved the staff of an accountant level 3 and an accounting technician. Once that system was in place, we could now perform that function with just the accounting technician, and it only took them a week to do. That allowed us to free up that accounting level 3 into more of an oversight position, and they can focus on other tasks within the agency, so much more efficient work process. And we've been highly successful in rolling out these systems, gaining the same kind of results of increased work capacity within staff. We've also focused on this idea of continuous process improvement using methodologies such as Lean and Kaizen. Lean is a methodology focused on eliminating waste and boosting efficiencies, and we've been applying that throughout the agency, actually. Things like our hiring decision workflow and our purchase order processing. We're not only making these processes much more efficient for administration, but for program staff as well. This allows them to spend less time doing administrative functions and putting more time putting boots on the ground in direct support of our mission. And I mentioned Kaizen. This is a methodology focused or spearheaded by Toyota decades ago and focuses on this idea of continuous improvement, this mentality of that. And we've been embracing that and applying it once again to all of our functions internally. And this really allows us to continually look at ways we're performing our processes. Oftentimes we'll improve process A and then move to process B, and in the course of improving that process, realize that more changes can be made to process A, and we'll go back and take a look at that. And that's that idea behind that continual improvement. To give you a sense of some of the efficiency we've gained in this area, we've recently applied these methodologies to our incoming revenue process. This is where we move federal revenue into our cash accounts for use. And in doing this, we drastically reduced the amount of time we were floating the federal agencies, as well as significantly increasing our cash flow. Give you a sense of the magnitude of the change, we went from an average of 49 days of moving a dollar through that process down to 10, and we're approaching 7 days. So huge improvements on efficiencies, and that's across the board on a lot of our processes. You can see similar results. We've also focused on this idea of shared services. We all work better as a team, whether it's to get done more quicker or to do it cheaper, and we've been applying this through other agencies. Currently, we're working with a shared arrangement with the Department of Forestry and the Department of Agriculture, where we provide our lien coordinator in exchange for use of forestry's internal auditor. And this works great for all the parties. It gives three departments capacity in two very important areas without any one department paying for two full-time FTEs. And given that we are looking inside to make all these efficiency changes, having this internal audit capacity is very important to us, and it's a position we've never had before, so it's a very good arrangement. And it also allows forestry and agriculture to apply the same kind of efficiency processes internally as well. As part of that arrangement, we participate in a shared audit committee where we review each other's internal auditing processes and provide feedback. What's really unique here is that this committee magnifies the benefits of this relationship, because oftentimes each department will be focusing on a different area of improvement with this internal auditor. And so if forestry is improving their procurement processes, we can glean some efficiencies from that. So it's a really magnification of the effort. Our lien coordinator is currently part of a payroll standardization process within all the natural resources agencies. The intent here is that we can provide some backup services if the process is standardized. If forestry's in a fire situation where their administrative staff is low, we can provide a payroll technician, and given that the process is similar, it would be an easy transition. So once again, benefit to many agencies. And we're providing some HR services to Department of Real Estate, given the extra capacity that we've gained in HR, given some of these efficiencies that we've made. So those are some of the core concepts that we've been using to focus delivering services this biennium with administration. I'd now like to move into the divisions that are actually implementing those concepts. First, we have our Administrative Services Division. And this division is key in providing a lot of core services to both those customers I spoke about earlier. First, we have our Sport and Commercial Licensing Unit. And as their name implies, they provide sport and commercial licensing services to that general public customer. In addition, they support more than 500 point-of-sale vendors across the state. These are the machines that you'll see at Bi-Mart and the Dick's Sporting Goods. To give you a sense of the amount of work that they provide, they process over 2.5 million transactions. Those are things such as licenses, permits, tags, things of that nature. Next, we have our Accounting and Contract Services Group. You've been hearing about the complexity of our revenue stream and our large reliance on federal money. Well, that equates to a hefty amount of work in the terms of managing contracts and providing accounting services to bill the work under those contracts. And this is a unit that's responsible for all that. Currently, they're managing nearly 500 active grants or contracts, and those contracts generate over 8,000 invoices a year, which equates to nearly $70 million in federal revenue. So given the increased complexities in billing and reporting on federal contracts, as well as the volume involved, you can understand why it was so important to update our accounts receivable system this biennium. Administrative services also provide services to our internal customers, the program staff, in the terms of directly supporting the operations and day-to-day services that our field locations provide. Give you a sense there that they're averaging over 4,000 payments to vendors just in terms of providing that day-to-day support. Next, we have our Human Resources Division. This division provides our personnel management across the agency. It includes things such as recruitment, safety, workforce enhancement, and employee relations. One thing that's significant in our department that you might not see in a comparable state agency our size is our reliance on a large seasonal workforce. This is a significant driver for our HR department as it really magnifies the amount of staff turnover and recruitment efforts that we must go through. HR is also key in managing and providing support to our labor management committee. Excuse me. And this is a committee made of represented staff and management staff, and really focuses on improving communications and enhancing relationships between that group. Very active group. And we do a lot of collaborative efforts through the committee and with SEIU. One of the ones that we're most proud of is our annual employee engagement survey. This survey allows us to keep kind of a finger on the pulse of our workforce, and we're currently getting ready to deploy our fourth annual cycle of this, and it's provided many positive inputs on how our staff feel. They feel very connected to our mission, enjoy the work they do, enjoy working for our department, primarily because they personally feel so vested in that mission that we're accomplishing. But it also identifies areas where we're missing the mark and that we do have work to do. One of the ones that we identified early on where we needed a little more effort was on our professional development front. Staff identified we didn't have quite the resources they felt they needed in this area. So using the feedback from these surveys, HR provided a internal website where we identified workforce enhancement opportunities within the agency, as well as career paths by program, and other resources, put it all in this place. So, for example, if you were a hatchery technician and you wanted to move up that career ladder, you could see within our agency what positions we had, what vacancies were there, what kind of training education you might need, and all in this one resource. And it's been a very positive resource for staff, as we've gleaned from subsequent surveys. But we also identified areas where we can improve it, and that's that tie into that continuous improvement cycle that we're applying to all facets of our business. Next, we have our Information Services Division. This is our IT group for the agency, and among other things, maintains our network security and connectivity across our agency. You've heard how many distributed offices and locations we have across the state, and this is a group that keeps them connected with a secure environment so we can get our work done. ISD also has our application development group, and they support a large number of applications that directly support our fish and wildlife programs, things such as collection of our commercial fishing revenue, our wildlife damage complaint hatchery management system. It's a long list of applications that support these programs. What's most significant here is previously all of these applications were on aging and dying mainframe technologies that were very expensive to maintain. And over the course of the last few years, we've been migrating those applications to newer technologies to reduce total cost of ownership and increase security and robustness. And we're almost done with that effort. We're slated to be done January 30th. And to my knowledge, this marks the first time that an Oregon state agency has completely migrated business processes of this magnitude off of a mainframe system. And once this is complete, we'll be able to decommission that mainframe and recover those resources, the time and the money spent keeping it alive, and apply it to better use within our agency. So once again, that tie into efficiencies, modernization efforts. ISD also has our help desk services. This is a group that provides for computer support across the agency. Given the distributed nature of our infrastructure and all the moving parts, you can imagine this group stays quite busy. Also very important, ISD provides oversight into our point of sale contract and that vendor that produces that solution. Lastly, we have our Information and Education Division. You heard Director Melcher talk quite at length that our recruitment, retention, and reactivation efforts, and this is the group that's behind those efforts, as well as the publications you received just the other day. This is a group that's key to all of that. They also focus on other initiatives, fish and wildlife and conservation initiatives within the agency. In addition, they're responsible for promotion and marketing efforts to encourage people to hunt, fish, and view wildlife. Now, certainly some of the key components for us moving forward and bridging that new base of new users and retention of our existing ones. Currently, we're in a pilot program with Oregon State University baseball to encourage people to go fishing. And you might think it's a strange relationship, but our market analysis has actually shown that the demographics that we want to target as potential enthusiasts are the ones that enjoy baseball. In this case, we're hoping specifically Beaver baseball.
Mr. Herbert, did you choose OSU baseball because they're a more winning program than the University of Oregon? Was that strategic?
I think there was some strategy.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Chair Rayfield, I think there were some strategies behind that. But certainly we have a longstanding relationship with Oregon State University. So there was some opportunities there. This is just one example of those creative approaches, those new approaches we're taking at recruitment efforts. And we're in the third and final year of this pilot program, and we're going to evaluate it using metrics that we're capturing. But we do know we're getting lots of great exposure. It's getting talked about. In fact, here's a video of something that might play at one of our sponsored events, and the announcer would then share our message with the people at the game, as well as identifying that all-important catch of the game. So it's just a fun way to get our way out in a new approach. A lot of good feedback there. Information and Education also manages our website and other online resources, once again, to encourage people, doing outreach events to encourage people to hunt, fish, and view wildlife, using a lot of the newer technology, social media, our Twitter accounts, all our Facebooks, and, you know, we're trying to keep up with how everything's moving forward. And they're also responsible for our education efforts, things like our hunter and angler education. And they do this through a coordination with a large amount of volunteer instructors. And to give you a sense of the impact that these volunteer instructors can have throughout the state, just in Hunter Ed alone, they were able to put on 300 classes. That's nearly one a day, and certify over 5,000 new hunters, a lot of them, you know, youth. Chair Rayfield, this kind of goes back to the message that you've been talking about the last couple of days and how difficult it is to engage children when their family aren't really involved in hunting or no longer involved in hunting. And some of these efforts really engage the children at these levels. I'm actually in your district in Corvallis, and my children are growing up with quite a few families that aren't involved in hunting. And I find it surprising how many of their friends have went out and taken hunter education on their own, even though their families aren't. You know, it's probably rare, but there are those opportunities. I think some of our outreach efforts are hitting the children, and we can start at that base and hopefully engage them at that root level. Information and Education is also responsible for our free fishing weekends, our family fishing events, and other outdoor skill clinics, and such as our pheasant hunting workshops. And I mentioned the pheasant hunting workshops once again so I can share a story I think that kind of can engage somebody that doesn't normally grow up in a hunting family. We recently received a letter from a young gentleman that grew up in a non-hunting family and then married into a hunting family and became interested in hunting, yet found it very intimidating hunting with his new family since they were such avid hunters. Well, he heard about one of our pheasant hunting workshops through one of those outreach efforts that INE is putting on, and he signed up himself, his father, and his grandfather up. And they went out and did this pheasant hunting workshop and learned how to safely shoot the shotguns and hunted the birds, took a few home, and had a great time. And he was writing us to thank us for this opportunity that allowed three generations to do something that they wouldn't have done in the past. And for me, it's hearing stories like these that really make me appreciate not only the work that INE does, but our agency as a whole. And so, you know, while we talk about budgets, positions, and such, ultimately it's all about bringing people together to enjoy the great natural resources in whatever capacity, be it hunting, fishing, or viewing wildlife while they're on a nature hike that Oregon has to offer. And that concludes my portion of the presentation. Absent any questions, I'd like to hand it over to Director Melcher for closing remarks.
Okay. Any questions?
I just want to follow up.
Back when we were talking about kind of efficiencies, and you said you provide human resource services to the Department of Real Estate, and I thought that was an odd pairing. And so I just wanted to know a little bit more about that.
Chair Rayfield, I don't have information at hand on how it evolved. Currently, we are providing low-cost services to them. We did have some extra capacity that allowed us to maintain some FTE in our HR department while providing their resources. I don't know if Director Melcher has anything more to add.
Sure. Co-Chair Devlin, Co-Chair Rayfield. I think the history of it was over the last, about a year ago, the Department of Real Estate came to us, and they're a very small agency that does not have their own HR staff, and they were looking for some HR services. We're, of course, the executive branch. We've been encouraged to use shared services among agencies, even if not a direct nexus between the agency's missions where appropriate. We've been encouraged to use shared services. So they came to us looking to basically contract with us to provide a partial, I think it's about one, I want to say it's about 0.1 FTE of HR support to their small agency. And so we developed an agreement. We have a formal agreement with them to provide those services at cost. So they're basically paying us the cost of the month or 2 months of employee time associated with those services.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Rayfield, if I might, this was an item of significant discussion in the General Government Subcommittee. I'm also the analyst for the Department of Administrative Services, and this came up as a concern because I believe the Real Estate Department was previously getting their services from DAS Shared Services, and they're going through some changes at DAS Shared Services, including charging full cost for the HR service they provided. Previously, it was subsidized by an assessment on all state agencies. So their Customer Utility Board wanted to end that subsidy. This has then caused their costs to go up, I believe, and they were looking at finding maybe a cheaper solution. They found one at the Department of Fish and Wildlife. But again, I would note for the record that the then Director of Department of Administrative Services did testify that the executive branch is interested in making sure that agencies at least receive HR services. They're more interested in making sure they get some service and not so much about who provides that service.
Anything additional? Okay. Director Melcher, would you like to close?
Sure, thank you.
Then I'll go to Mr. Whitman.
Appreciate it, and I'll be brief because I know we have other testifiers here behind me perhaps waiting. But I did want to say, I want to make one comment as well on the hunter education piece and this issue of non-hunting families and interest among juveniles that aren't perhaps part of a hunting heritage. Anytime I talk to folks about their children's interest in hunter education, even in a non-hunting family, I always encourage them to have their child take that course for one very important reason. The day they turn 18, they aren't required to have that training. And there's not much difference between a 17-year-old and an 18-year-old. So you're much better off having your child trained, made aware of all this related safety as well as regulatory issues before they no longer are required to have that training. So I think it's an important point. I'll be brief here then. I think we wanted to wrap up a little bit. I hope over the last 3 days that we've given you a good sense of the diversity of issues that we work on the really the complexity, all the overlays, both federal, international, local overlays related to our work on fish and wildlife. I hope we've highlighted some of our important efforts. We're going to, as Bill just mentioned, we'll continuously work to improve our internal processes, to build efficiencies within the agency, continuing to work, continuing to work to make fishing and hunting better in Oregon, and I won't go through each of these. I think our earlier speakers had talked about all of them in detail. Continuing to work on attracting new participants, continuing to make and propose regulations that are easier to understand and simplified as an important way to lower the barriers to participation. But then embedded in all this is our commitment to conservation and stewardship of these resources. We recognize we manage all the state's fish and wildlife for all the state's citizens, not just folks who buy hunting and fishing licenses. Our work on habitat is key. We're not a regulatory agency as it relates to habitat, but we do work collaboratively with other agencies as well as private landowners to improve fish and wildlife habitat across the state. And with that, Mr. Chair, I appreciate the last 3 days, and we'd be happy to answer any follow-up questions.
Any questions for the director? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Whitman, would you come forward? Oh, and we need to do the DAS presentation. Well, Mr. Whitman, before you speak, we'll do just the DAS presentation, if we could. Notice I used the old terminology.
Co-Chair Devlin, Co-Chair Rayfield, I'm Kathy Conley from the Chief Financial Office at the Department of Administrative Services, and I just have a very brief presentation for the Department of Fish and Wildlife, because they've done an excellent job of presenting their budget to you, the governor's budget to you. The emerging issues for this agency are obviously providing a stable revenue stream for the agency and recognition of the increasing conservation responsibilities that this agency has for all of the state. They contribute to the 10-year healthy plant environment vision by conserving and restoring natural habitats and building strong and sustainable communities, particularly rural communities, but communities throughout the state. This is their brief expenditure history. Things to note here, as you've heard me say before, lottery funds are a very small part of this agency, but they are certainly not going to be rising and maybe at best flat in the coming biennia. The general fund for the agency is rising. The governor's budget does make an investment in general fund, mostly to offset the declining other fund or that in comparison to the costs. I would note the FTE line, it is actually taking a bend down in this budget, which many of the natural resource agencies, that isn't the case, but is the case in this agency. Investments, this is just a general summary of sort of the numbers surrounding the packages that the agencies have described to you in much more detail. There is, in general fund, the governor's budget invests $8.7 million, which is an increase over the current biennium. Lottery funds are going down, and the other funds is an additional increase for the agency. Federal funds has a lot of one-time, and they always do, they always have a lot of one-time funding, so we're having in and outs with this, but there is an overall increase in this agency's budget. I did want to note a couple things. In the agency's budget, they requested funding for the Oregon State Police Force Fish and Wildlife Division. This funding is in the governor's budget, but it is in OSP's budget. It is not in ODFW's, and that was noted by LFO staff in their presentation also, and we would certainly concur that that's the correct place for it, is to just place it there directly rather than have it transferred from ODFW. And there are fee changes in this. Most of these are in the fee bill, which will be this committee will hear about. There are a few small fees that are administratively changed, but they also underlie this budget and the increase in those fees also. In their budget, the agency does provide a whole list of those fees. issues that may come up. There is a proposed task force on fish and wildlife funding. We may be returning to ask for additional limitation if certain federal grants that have been applied for are received. That depends on the timing of the grants. Finally, there are a couple of corrections that will need to be made in this agency's budget bill. In package 102, the revenue shortfall bill, there was an incorrect reduction in general fund in that package. At the same time, in package 090, there was a data entry error that increased general fund. The overall offset is about $90,000 in balance. We'll be working with LFO to correct those. In addition, there's a few technical, very technical changes that we'll work with LFO on also. So with that, unless there are any questions, co-chairs?
Any questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you very much. Mr. Whitman.
Good morning, Co-Chair Devlin, Co-Chair Rayfield, members of the committee. For the record, my name's Richard Whitman, Governor Brown's Natural Resource Advisor. I'm here today to make a short presentation on another issue that cuts across multiple state agency budgets, in this case, the partnership effort to conserve sage grouse in Oregon. There are actually seven policy option packages spread across four agencies, including three for ODFW, one for the Oregon Department of Forestry, two for the Oregon Department of Agriculture, and one for the Department of Land Conservation and Development, all relating and all coordinated around the sage-grouse conservation effort. So I'm going to give you a brief presentation on why you should care about sage-grouse conservation and funding those programs, and then end up with a little bit more detail on the different policy option packages. First of all, a little bit of background. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service made a decision in 2010 that the listing of sage-grouse is warranted in the 11 western states where sage-grouse is present. In essence, the sage-grouse has the potential to be the northern spotted owl of central and eastern Oregon. In fact, the land area that would be affected by a listing of sage-grouse in central and eastern Oregon is actually more extensive than the land area that is affected by the northern spotted owl listing. That decision was made in 2010, so we were essentially given under a court decision requiring the Fish and Wildlife Service to make a decision by September of this year, 5 years to turn this bus around and convince the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service that a listing is not warranted. And similar efforts are going on in the other western states with sage-grouse habitat. Other reasons to care, obviously central and eastern Oregon have been some of the hardest hit and slowest to recover from the Great Recession. And in addition, the main industry that would be affected by this is Oregon's cattle industry, which is an over $500 million industry. It's the second highest commodity in our ag industry, which in turn is the second most important economic sector in the state of Oregon. So what are the issues in Oregon? Why was listing proposed? Well, first of all, wildfire. We've had extensive range fires in Oregon, particularly over the last several years. The spread of juniper and invasive weeds that crowds out sage-grouse. And then finally, habitat fragmentation. There are efforts underway administratively before the Fish and Wildlife Commission and the Land Conservation and Development Commission to deal with the habitat fragmentation issue. The basic strategy of the state is around something called core areas, and you'll see a map in a minute about that, but the idea is to focus protection on a fairly small portion of sage-grouse area that is most important to the conservation of that species. Next slide, please. So the work in Oregon really began with the Oregon cattlemen who have developed something called a candidate conservation agreement with assurances. that allows ranchers to sign up and agree to certain conservation practices. In return, they are assured that they won't have to do anything else, even if sage grouse are listed in the western U.S. The Secretary of Interior and Governor Brown were out in Bend at a signing ceremony with the cattlemen, signing that agreement at the end of last week. Another element of Oregon's plan is related to wildfire, building capacity in our local rangeland fire protection associations, and also investing through ODFW in actions to reduce the risk of wildfire and then also help recover from wildfire when it does occur. With regard to juniper and invasive weeds, there are significant investments that have been made and are being made by the federal government through the Natural Resources Conservation Services. Oregon was successful in receiving a $9 million grant from NRCS earlier this year. And the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board has also invested significantly in that effort. And I've already mentioned the programs on habitat fragmentation. So this really is a partnership. We've got groups involved in this that range from the Oregon Cattlemen to the Oregon Natural Desert Association. The effort is co-convened by the Oregon governor, the state director of the Bureau of Land Management, the state director of the Natural Resource Conservation Services, as well as with participation from the Farm Bureau, counties, Oregon Department of Forestry, renewable energy producers, mining interest, and other conservation groups. The university system is providing technical support for this, as is the Nature Conservancy. The goals here really are sustaining rural communities as well as their economies and the natural resources that they depend on. So this is the geographic area that we're talking about. The areas in brown are the core areas that I referred to where conservation efforts are being focused. And the area in light green is the remainder of the habitat of sage grouse in Oregon. And you can see that we're talking all the way from central Oregon, Crook and Deschutes County, out into eastern, southeastern Oregon, and then also up into Baker in the very southern part of Union County. Next slide. The other aspect of this challenge is ownership fragmentation. So the Bureau of Land Management owns and the federal government owns and manages a large, very large portion, around 70% of sage grouse habitat in southeastern Oregon. That's the light brown color that you see. The Forest Service, which has the green color, has a small portion of the area as well. So the Bureau, at the same time, we are working on a state, local, private effort. The Bureau of Land Management is working on an effort on BLM lands. The state plan will come out in June, July of this year. The Bureau of Land Management will also issue its plans this summer. And that's all coming together in preparation for a decision by the Fish and Wildlife Service in U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in September of this year. Next. So finally, I want to just highlight the budget packages. As I mentioned, there are seven specific policy option packages related to this effort, one for the Department of Forestry related to wildfire capacity building for our local rural fire protection associations of over $1.5 million, and then two packages actually for the Oregon Department of Agriculture related to invasive weeds and juniper removal. And then three packages for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, again, related to wildfire, working with landowners on practices to reduce fire risk. And also working with landowners to implement those candidate conservation agreements that I referred to earlier. And then finally, and importantly, administering on all lands, federal, state, private land mitigation system, so that when people come in and want to do something in sage grouse habitat, they can know upfront what their obligations are for mitigation. They don't have to get into a project-by-project negotiation. And the partnership of agencies and conservation groups and local government can collectively decide where those mitigation resources are best targeted to get the maximum conservation benefit for sage-grouse. That system will be, under this proposal, would be administered by the Department of Fish and Wildlife Service. And then finally, there's a position at the Department of Land Conservation and Development. This relates to the rulemakings that are going on before the Land Conservation and Development Commission and the Fish and Wildlife Commission that are creating some regulatory backstops to assure the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service that Oregon has this issue covered and to, again, designed to avoid a listing in the state of Oregon. The final thing I want to mention is there are some pieces of legislation that may provide some additional funding for this effort. There's House Bill 3401. There are ongoing discussions with the Oregon cattlemen and other interests about revenue sources to support this effort. Representative Bentz has also introduced legislation, House Bill 3343, related to funding this effort. And then finally, I need to mention that the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board has been and is expected to continue to be a significant funder through its grant program using lottery funds for sage-grouse conservation. OWEB has invested over $8.5 million in sage-grouse conservation over since about 2001. Again, helping us get to where we are today, and it's expected that there will be significant continuing investment from OWEB as this effort moves forward. This is not something that is going to be solved overnight. Juniper control, invasive weeds, wildfire are issues that are going to be with us indefinitely, and so this is something where we need to invest, and we're going to need to continue to invest along with leveraging significant resources from both the federal government and from other partners in this conservation effort. So again, this is another presentation where I'm highlighting for you a multi-agency set of policy option packages around an issue that really requires coordination between multiple agencies. With that, that's my presentation on this. I would be happy to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Okay. Any questions for Ms. Twitman? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And tomorrow we have a public hearing. Thank you very much for the presentation. My apologies that I have not personally been able to be here that much this week. I do want to let you know that I believe my my other co-chairs of the Joint Committee has probably had as many meetings as I have had on ODFW. I think I'm on well over a dozen meetings with advocates on both sides of issues, probably going to two dozen. So I've gotten just a little bit of slice of what your daily life must be like. So anything else for the good of the order? Hearing none?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I see that Bobby Levy is here. Did she want to speak? She's the chair of the board.
At the beginning.
Oh, okay.
Oh, did she?
Okay.
Actually, I'm not the chair anymore. I'm kind of rotating to be out.
Oh, okay.
I just would hope that you would pass.
Would you want to come forward? Actually, we would need to note it for the record that you.
And I had not intended.
And please identify yourself for the record. So.
I'm Bobby Levy. I represent District 2 on the Fish and Wildlife Commission, former chair. And hopefully I'm transitioning to be not on the commission pretty soon. But I would hope that you would pass the Fish and Wildlife budget. They manage their money very well. And I would hope that you would just pass the budget and vote for it favor of what they're asking.
Okay. Any questions? Thank you very much for coming forward. With that, we are adjourned.
Can I talk to you for a moment?